Hi, I'm Eric Francia, President and CEO of ASEN, an Ayala company committed to net zero, and you're watching the maiden episode of Power Podcast.
Power Podcast is a production of Power Philippines, the only online publication in the country dedicated to covering energy developments across the archipelago. We cover all news and issues which spark meaningful conversations among members of our growing online community. Like them, we believe that sustaining the growth of the energy sector is vital to the growth of the country itself. I'm your host, Francis Respicio. Let's get on with the show.
And good afternoon to all of you, whether you're watching on our Facebook or YouTube page. A very good afternoon. Magandang hapon po sa inyo lahat. And welcome to this very first episode of Power Podcast. Very timely ating episode ngayong hapon, especially with the recently concluded COP26 Climate Conference. And so here with us this afternoon is ASEN President and CEO Eric Francia. Sir Eric, good afternoon and thank you very much for joining us in our very first episode of Power Podcast.
Hi, good afternoon to you, Francis.
Yes, thank you very much, sir, for joining us. First, let's begin first with the rebranding as we shown in that video earlier. As many of our followers know, so you rebranded into ASEN with a new logo last Friday. And could you tell us more about this rebranding? And did you purposely launch this at the end of COP26?
Yeah, well, it's a coincidence, Francis, as to the timing. But we thought that this is the right time for us to launch as a standalone brand, given that we're already one of the core businesses of Ayala Corporation, you know. So, but we also wanted to encapsulate the spirit of AC Energy, and as you know, that AC Energy, the shorthand and the ticker symbol are ASEN. So we thought that ASEN as a brand, this is a new brand for AC Energy, would be a great choice. It is very bold, as you can see in our logo. It's not your typical light blue, light green that stands for renewables and sustainability, because we believe that the renewable revolution is something that will be very challenging. So we want to exude boldness, the challenger spirit, given that energy transition will be challenging. There's a lot of volatility, uncertainty, as we're seeing these days around us, right? So we want to be able to lead the charge in the renewables revolution, and that's what ASEN stands for.
That's great to know, sir. And could you explain to us also the meaning of the logo, of the new logo, sir?
Yeah, well, the logo is quite versatile, which again reflects our character. We're very agile. Of course, you can see that it reflects the letter A, but it's more than just that. No? So as you can see in our teasers and in our video, the logo, the mark, is very versatile, that it can form the sun, the wind, trees, and many other are relevant figures now. So you can really see the versatility and agility the organization exudes.
All right, sir. And what does this rebranding mean for your stakeholders? So whether that's the Ayala Group, the investors, or in the general public?
So it coincides with our commitment to net zero, as well as our announcement that ASEN will be the renewables platform of the Ayala Group. Alongside with that is our commitment to transition to become a 100% renewables platform by 2025, as you mentioned. Happy to discuss this later, but I think it's good to get the brand, the what it stands for, upfront, so that the investors and all the stakeholders will be very clear as to who we are and what we aim to achieve.
All right, sir. Now, we were talking about COP26 earlier, and one of the buzzwords that came out of COP26, if we may say, is the ETM, or the Energy Transition Mechanism, which for the benefit of our viewers, simply involves a buyout of coal power plants. So in fact, the ADB partnered with the Philippines and Indonesia for this purpose during COP26. Based on your working knowledge, sir, would you or can you explain to us how ETM actually works?
Yeah, this is a very interesting area, Francis. And just a little bit of a background, the reason why we threw our hat in the ring and want to embrace this concept, and again, a lot of credit goes to ADB and the other stakeholders who are pushing for this very innovative concept, is as a background, as you recall, as an AC Energy group, we committed to divest all of our coal plants, and we announced that almost 2 years ago. It's a very good policy because the proceeds of that divestment will be used, will be recycled, and help us accelerate our scaling up of renewables, which is in and of itself a good thing. There is a however. And some of our investors, especially the ESG-oriented investors, have told us, given us feedback, that while it is a good thing to divest and reinvest proceeds to renewables, aren't we concerned about passing the issue to somebody else, those emissions and so forth? You know, so I also happen, we AC Energy or ACEN is part of the Just Energy Transition Initiative under the Council for Inclusive Capitalism. We just released some information on that as well with other global energy companies such as BP, Repsol, Anglo American, etc. And part of this, again, reflects that concept that a just transition also talks about transitioning to the coal technology to cleaner and newer technologies, but also the need to transition the people and the communities that they serve. So it gave us a lot of pause, and we revisited that notion of a plain vanilla divestment and recycling of capital. So when ADB and other groups announced their intention to push for this ETM, it piqued our interest and studied it very swiftly, and ended up appointing BPI as our arranger. What it is, Francis, is there is a purpose-driven investors who can provide low-cost funding, right, with a purpose of buying out coal plants with the objective of retiring them earlier than their technical life. So to me, it's a big insight. Yes, these investors will be investing in coal plants technically, but there's a good reason. There's two reasons. One is their investment will enable the early retirement of the coal plants. And number two, the proceeds of those investments will be reinvested for renewable energy projects. So to us, if these investors exist, and we believe that they do after doing some market sounding, I think it's a fantastic opportunity for us to do a just energy transition. So hopefully we will be one of the first ones to do it, notwithstanding the fact that other organizations are still in feasibility stage. I think our project, number one, SL Tech is 100% owned by ASEN. So we don't have partners to deal with, so we can control the destiny. And number two, it's a small enough coal plant, 244 megawatts, that it's a good a pilot example. So I think there's going to be a lot of learnings in what could be the first ETM project, and we're hoping to close this by early next year, and we would be more than happy to share the learnings so that ADB and the likes will pick the lessons learned from our own experience. So we're obviously in touch with ADB to make sure that we exchange notes and understand their learnings as well that we want to incorporate for ours.
That's actually what we heard about Kalaka, SL Tech, and that really interested us. But how are you actually going to do this? To do the buy, to do the ETM and the buyout for SL Tech?
Yeah, so I think there's two components here. One is there's a debt component, right? And there's also an equity component. So we need to be able to address both components. So when in our discussions with our arranger BPI, we we are not only focusing on the equity, but also both the debt and equity. So part of it is also lengthening the maturity to be able to help the economics of the plant. So the debt will help. And then, of course, the equity, we would be looking for investors who are not who are willing to take returns that are acceptable to them that will allow us to retire the plant early. Because that's at the center of the ETM concept, when ADB and others talk about it, it's the ability for them to source low-cost funding, right? So that because of the low returns, lower than usual returns that are acceptable to these investors, then as asset owners or sponsors, we'll be able to shorten the cash flow or the life of the plant. You know? So instead of running it, you know, SLTech was built in 2015. So and coal plants typically run for 40 to 50 years. We do have one of the oldest plants is our neighbor in Calaca. No, that's already 30 years old. No, that, I think that was built in the 80s, if I'm not mistaken. So, but SLTech can run in theory until 2055 or even 2065. But we're saying no, we will only run it until 2040. 15 to 25 years ahead of a technical life. And we will be able to do that because when we sell this to the ETM investors, the returns, at least to us, won't be so bad because we will convert that into a non-coal plant. We will commit as part of our just energy transition, notwithstanding the fact that we will be divesting this, we will assume responsibility and accountability to make sure that this gets transitioned in a just manner.
Right. That's good. That's really great to hear. The concept actually of ETM is really exciting in itself.
And I think, Francis, I think the one, hopefully it will become mainstream. In Australia, for example, while there's no ETM concept, there's a more natural progression in Australia where they are very systematic about scheduling the closure of coal plants. Although arguably in Australia, they have older plants than the Philippines. Most of their plants were built in the 70s, not 80s, coal plants, that is. And a lot of them, as you can imagine, are reaching 40, 50 years old over the next decade or so. So they have a schedule of when each coal plant will be closed down. For example, the next big one, Liddell Power Station, will be closed down between end of 2022 to 2023. So it allows the industry, and being an industry player in Australia, it allows us to take a view of the market, knowing that there will be a significant coal plant that will be shut down. Then the rest of the industry can be proactive enough to replace that with new capacity. Now, hopefully that will be the norm. Especially in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia, that we begin scheduling the shutting down of the coal plants, and better if we are able to commit even earlier than the 40 to 50-year-old technical life. No, so hopefully this will be the first but not the last. So hopefully this will set a roadmap or a template for others to also consider.
Oh, okay, that's really, really great to hear, sir. Now, also before COP26, I'd like to ask this one. AC Energy at the time and the entire Ayala Group announced its commitment to net zero by 2050. Now, for the benefit of our audience, especially those who have a newfound interest in the energy sector, could you explain to us, sir, the concept of net zero and why 2050? Bakit 2050 yung target?
Yeah, so the net zero concept obviously was not invented by Ayala. Now, there's a global movement on net zero. I think the first country to commit to net zero a couple of years ago was the UK. And then now, you know, around 137 countries have committed to net zero, maybe more now given COP26. 25% of the top 2,000 corporates globally have also committed to net zero. Now, net zero is different from carbon neutrality. So, you know, it took time for me to absorb that. So happy to share with you the what is the global definition of net zero. So number one, Francis, net zero does not only look at carbon emissions, but also the other GHG or greenhouse gases. So the next most significant or potent GHG is methane. That's also considered number one. Number two, net zero does not only look at scope one and scope two emissions, that is your direct emissions and emissions that you generate through the purchase of electricity, which is scope one and scope two. It also includes scope three, which is the most challenging, arguably, among the three scopes. Types of emissions. Scope three is the emissions of your supply chain, of your entire ecosystem. If you're a bank, it includes the emissions of who you lend to. If you're a real estate company, it includes the emissions of your subcontractors and so forth. Or in our case, it includes the emissions of, you know, the solar panel manufacturers, for example. So you'll need to look at not only at your own operations, but your operations for your entire supply chain. If you're a coal miner, for example, scope three will include the emissions of your customers, for instance, who use your coal to produce electricity and emit. So as you can imagine, it's but the spirit of net zero is making sure that we are all in this together, that you don't only influence your own operations, but also the operations of your entire ecosystem. The third concept, I guess, so important concept of net zero is how you get to net zero. And the word net as opposed to gross zero is part of this, which is the how, you know, which is quite important. So broadly, there are three methods to get to net zero, to achieve. Number one is to reduce your emissions. And you can do this, for example, by using renewable energy or electric vehicles, for instance. So that would help with your scope one and two emissions, typically. Number two, you can also capture. So this is where nature-based solutions, if you undertake nature-based carbon sinks, for example, carbon forests, that would help eliminate carbon emissions, or technologies such as CCS, carbon capture and storage. So that's the second methodology in terms of eliminating carbon emissions. And then the third, typically as a last resort, you can compensate. No, through a purchase of carbon credits. Now, for these are carbon credits, and this is where the netting out really comes in. No, you're allowed to purchase as well, and that's why I think the carbon market over time will become big. No, as more and more companies commit to net zero, there will be a market for the suppliers of carbon credits as well as buyers. In Europe, for example, they have a regulated carbon market because there is a cap and trade policy. So there are quota systems, there are limits to European companies on emissions. So there is a penalty, if you will. If you emit more than what's required, you need to buy in the carbon market. And that's why the price of carbon in Europe is, for example, quite significant. It's reaching 60 plus euros per ton. In the voluntary market, which is effectively most of the rest of the world, where it's just voluntary among the companies, the carbon market isn't as robust as the one in Europe. No? So as a result, carbon prices are relatively low compared to the European regulated markets. No, but it's still significant. I think carbon sink projects go for about $8 or $10 per ton, and renewable energy credits go for $1 to $2 per ton. So, but I think over time, that's a market to look out for as more people, more companies commit to net zero.
All right, sir. And then as part of the net transition to net zero, ASIN is not just having 5,000 megawatts in RE assets, but it is also planning to have an all RE portfolio by 2025, if I'm not mistaken. Where are we at this point with that 5,000 megawatt all RE goal?
Yeah. Sorry, Francis. Just one quick thing I failed to mention. Why 2050? It's because of the science. This is science-based. The net zero tries to limit the increase in global temperature to 1.5 degrees relative to pre-industrial levels. No. I think we are on track to getting to more than 3 degrees if we did on a do-nothing scenario, which would be disastrous, frankly speaking. A lot of areas in the world will be underwater by the end of the century. So there is urgency to this. And by the estimation, based on the based on science, on targets and so forth, the world needs to get to net zero by 2050 to limit the increase in temperature to 1.5 degrees. So there's a science behind it. Now, it doesn't mean that everyone needs to get to net zero by 2050. Some will be earlier, and some, like the developing markets, can be later. No, but we chose what is the global norm, which is 2050. So that's the commitment from an Ayala and an ASEN perspective. So as part of that, Francis, to your next question, this is also partly the reason why we elected ASEN to be the a pure renewables platform of the Ayala group. Now, having said that, from an Ayala group standpoint, we believe that the getting to net zero will entail a transition. It's not going to happen overnight, number one. And part of that is that there is a role for thermal power, for example, gas, as a transition fuel. And even before gas, diesel, in the case of the Philippines, we do have diesel plants. I know we'll talk about diesel in a bit. But there is a role to play because there's no LNG yet in the Philippines, but you need peaking capacity, you need ancillary capacity, a quick response plant. Battery storage is not yet at the level that will obsolete diesel plants. So it's still a necessary technology or fuel for us to have. So again, hopefully over time, we will have less reliance on diesel plants, and over time, we will have less reliance on gas plants. But for gas, it's going to take multiple decades, I think, before we can have zero reliance on gas. So as a result, we've said, okay, we will focus ASEN to become the renewables platform because we have a lot of investors who would really love for ASEN to focus on renewables. No questions asked. No, but from an Ayala Group standpoint, if we look at the landscape and what the country needs, we believe we also have to walk the talk, and we believe that we cannot survive by just relying on renewables. So what we've done was we've reconstituted Enixor, which is our other listed platform, to become the energy transition platform of the group, right? So we will be transferring our thermal assets like diesel from ASEN to Enixor, and then we will orient Enixor to provide the transition fuel or technology, be it diesel, be it natural gas. We just signed an agreement with a Blackstone affiliate last week, I believe, to work on a project that would have a component of gas, but we would have a dual fuel so that it will be future ready when hydrogen becomes economic and competitive. No? So that will be baked into the design of the plant. And that's an example of how we will manage energy transition, whether it's advanced R&D and development of green hydrogen. I know it's still very early days, or carbon capture and storage technologies or what have you. No, but that would be the role of NXOR, because we cannot just switch off all the thermal plants and go 100% RE overnight. But having said that, I think having two distinct platforms will make us sharper in terms of the focus areas of these two important components. You've got renewables on the one hand, and then the energy transition components. Of course, renewables is part of energy transition, but what I mean is the transition technologies that may involve fossil fuel in the meantime, and just mitigating that over time.
But in terms, sir, of yung attributable capacity, there's a 5,000. How, like, where are we? Like, how many megawatts na tayo at this point?
Yeah, so today, ASEN has around 2,500 megawatts of attributable renewable capacity in the Philippines and around the region. So we're almost exactly at the halfway mark relative to our 5,000 megawatt goal with 4 years to go. We decided to have 2025 as our benchmark year. by early next year, we expect the number to be closer to 3,000 megawatts. We've already announced and approved the equity funding for a 200 megawatt solar project in Cagayan, our joint venture with CleanTech. We've also we have an imminent project in India, another 400 megawatt project in India. That's our next, our third project in India. So both of those projects are expected to reach financial close in the next few months. So I think from 2,500, we can get quickly to 3,000 in the next three to 6 months at most. No? So yeah, the momentum is definitely there. I do expect, I'd be disappointed if we only meet, I would like to exceed the 5,000 megawatt goal by 2025. But I think we've got a good fighting chance given where we are today and given where our pipeline is. We just updated our pipeline, especially following the acquisitions that we made. We do have some consolidation moves in the market. We've acquired the interest of our partners in UPC Australia and UPC in the Philippines, as well as our partners in Northwind. Obviously, as a result, we increased our pipeline as well. It used to be 12,000 megawatts of pipeline across the region. Following the recent acquisitions, which have yet to reach financial close, but I think we'll get there sometime 2022. Following that, and following the updating of our pipeline in the Philippines, we are now at approximately 18,000 megawatts of pipeline that would help push our renewable capacity from where it is today, which is 2,500, to well over 5,000 megawatts by 2025.
That's great. That's really great to hear, sir. And following the conclusion of COP26, how do you see things progressing for RE in general in the Philippines in the coming years?
Well, I hope that a lot will depend, of course, on the next administration or leadership in the country to really set the aspirational targets. I believe that our targets need to be aspirational. On the one hand, but on the other hand, I know there's a camp as well that looks at the cost implications of being aspirational on sustainability targets. No, one can argue are our plans aspirational enough? I think Senator Win Gachalian did mention that he doesn't think so. That we can do better, and I tend to agree with that. For example, we do have a commitment. A soft commitment, a qualified commitment to reduce emissions by 75% by 2030, but a lot of that is contingent on foreign support, funding support. I think the hard target there is low single digit. I don't know if it's 2 or 3% reduction. But even with that, is There's two questions. One is it aspirational enough? And number two is, do we have specific policies, credible policies and programs, and the will to implement those policies? So I think there's still a lot of open questions. As it is now, Francis, if you look at just the next 10 years or so, 2030, I know that as part of the government policy or goal, it's to get renewables share of output to increase from where it is today, which is around 21% share of output, to 35% by 2030. I'm happy to provide you the nuances and the details behind these numbers. But even with that, first of all, it's a goal that's not easy to achieve, but I think we have a good shot at that. But number two, if our goal is quote-unquote limited to that, our carbon emissions will still increase between now and 2030, despite the fact that you're increasing renewable share. By my estimation, based on those numbers, we will increase our emissions by 35 to 40%, as opposed to going the other way around, which is reducing it. So there's an open question whether our goals are aspirational enough relative to what the world needs, what COP26 and what net zero calls for, the science behind it, number one. And number two, whether our policies are strong enough. And number three, whether we're enforcing those policies as well.
And then now, of course, now we've already talked about the general situation. I'd like to continue that further. Before the pandemic, DOE had this projection that the country would need, and let me quote this one, 30,189 megawatts by 2030. Now, dependable capacity as of the end of 2020 was at 23,400, around that area. Now, considering that the economy is slowly opening up, and let's hope that the COVID cases remain down, do you see that this projection would, or do you agree with this projection of the DOE?
Kulang yan, Francis. Kulang. Let me explain. There's a lot of nuances in that 30,000 megawatt number. No? I mean, are you saying that we'll only grow by 7,000 megawatts in the next 9 years? Kulang. Yeah. So to put things into perspective, I think let's talk about megawatts and let's talk about output, which is gigawatt hours or kilowatt hours, no? Because those are two separate things that people typically confuse. No? One is installed capacity, which is what you have now, and the other one is the output that it produces. No? So just to put into perspective, yes, your numbers are right. We have 23,400 dependable capacity, that's installed and dependable capacity around the country as of 2020. To put things into perspective, the output, now in terms of kilowatt hours or gigawatt hours, that the country consumed in 2020, which was a pandemic year, it was approximately 102 terawatt hours, or I'd like to talk about kilowatt hours because it's closer to our household bills. So that's about 102. It's just under 102 billion kilowatt hours that we consumed as a country during a COVID year in 2020. Prior to that, pre-COVID, it was close to 106 billion kilowatt hours. So there was around 4% reduction because of COVID. I believe that this year we should be back close to the pre-COVID levels, if not slightly more. We don't have the numbers yet because the year is not done, but I won't be surprised if we will be back at the 106, 107, 108 billion kilowatt hours. Okay, so now that number is supported by the generation, the fleet that we have, which is 23,400 megawatts, as you mentioned. And out of the 23,400, there's about 16,500 of thermal and 6 1,800 of renewables, right? Now, the important number to look at is what did those capacities produce relative to the 102 billion or the 106 billion kilowatt hours? Well, it's the 80-20. 79% was supplied for by thermal, which is about 80 billion kilowatt hours, right, out of the 101, 102, or 106, depending on which year you're looking at. And around 22 billion kilowatt hours was supplied by renewables. And that's where the 21% is coming from. Now, it's 22 billion divided by 106 billion kilowatt hours, right? Now, that is where we are today, more or less, okay? Now, you now project 2030, since that's the milestone year that DOE has identified or determined. Historically, we've been growing between 2010 and 2019, prior to the pandemic, we've been growing at around 5.1% compounded annual growth rate, you know, in the last 10 years or so. Had the pandemic didn't not happened, and you continued that 5.1% CAGR, by 2030, we would be at around more than 180 billion kilowatt hours. So yung 106 billion noong 2019 should have would be at around 180, 185 billion kilowatt hours by 2030. Okay? So remember that number. Now, given that the pandemic delayed, you know, set back the growth by 2 years, because we're now 2021 is going to be similar to 2019. If you just applied that 5.1% on 2021 base year, we would be at around 160 plus billion kilowatt hours by 2030. My crystal ball says we will be somewhere in between 160 to 180. To 170. This is an art and science, no? Ballpark lang, back of the envelope. So let's say we will be around 170 billion kilowatt hours of output demand by 2030. Now you say, okay, what is DOE's objective goal? 35% RE. You multiply 35% to that 170, you have to be at around 60 plus billion kilowatt hours supplied by renewables versus where we are today, which is 22 billion kilowatt hours of renewables. So we need to triple, okay? We need to triple the output of renewables to get to that 60 plus billion kilowatt hours by 2030 to get to that 35% renewable share of output. Now, what about thermal? So if our crystal ball says we will be at 170 billion kilowatt hours by 2030, 65% of that will be supplied by thermal, right? And that's around 110 billion kilowatt hours of thermal, okay? Supplied by coal, gas, and diesel, mostly coal and gas, no? Versus where we were in 2020, which is about 80 billion. So we're almost there, 80 versus 110, right? And guess what? What the 2020 number doesn't reflect yet are coal plants that are under construction, such as GN Dinginin, which will be 668 times two. And then there are San Miguel plants that are being built in Mariveles. I believe it's around 600 plus. The baseload contract that they won on the Meralco bid, which is another 1,800. So there's around 3,700 megawatts of coal and gas that are already committed or being built. And that represents around 20 plus billion kilowatt hours. So if you look at it, Francis, we're almost there in terms of thermal requirements, right? If you included the committed and capacity under construction in thermal, we would be over 100 billion kilowatt hours already. And we only need around 110 by 2030, right? So all we need is like 10 billion kilowatt hours more. But you have to remember that, number one, we need some buffer capacity, some reserve capacity, because power is tight today. And then number two, you need to also replace the aging coal plants or gas plants that are degrading over time. So the availability or dependability is reducing every time, every year. No, so if you take all that into consideration, to cut my long story short, our rough estimate is we probably need, on top of the plants that are already committed, we need probably around 2,500 megawatts of thermal, new thermal capacity, on or before 2030, perhaps at the latter part of this decade. And ideally, that would come from gas, not coal, but gas. Economics are question mark whether gas or coal is going to be more competitive, but obviously from an environmental impact, gas would be far superior and far more flexible and more complementary with renewables as well. No, so I think now, so that's insofar as thermal is concerned. Now, the tripling of renewables requirement, no, from 22 billion kilowatt hours to 60 plus billion kilowatt hours by 2030, what does that additional 38 billion kilowatt hours look like in terms of installed capacity? Well, the answer is depending on your assumed technology mix. I have my own assumption. Happy to tell you what the assumption is, but this is not engraved in stone. I'm not the government mandating all this, or it's not a perfect crystal ball. But it's a hypothesis. One scenario is what I call a solar-driven scenario, where we would to produce that incremental 38 billion kilowatt hours of renewables to get us to that 35% goal. We need to build around 18,000 megawatts of renewables between now and 2030. And the breakdown of that approximately is about 14,000 megawatts of solar and about 2,500 megawatts of wind and 1,500 megawatts between geothermal, hydro, and biomass. Okay, now you can say, okay, where did I get those numbers? Well, it's finger in the air. It's a scenario. Now you can argue it's biased because we are big on solar and wind, but there's a possibility that geothermal, hydro, and biomass could step up to the plate. It's a balance. It's a scenario. You could argue, yeah, maybe the 1,500 of geothermal, biomass, and hydro could be double to 3,000, then you won't need 14,000 megawatts of solar. Maybe 10,000 megawatts of solar would be enough. And therefore, my 18,000 is an overstatement. It's closer to 14 or 15,000 megawatts of renewables. But that's the order of magnitude, Francis. 15 to 20,000 megawatts of renewables that we need to build in the next 8 to 9 years. That's a lot of capacity. That's about 2,000 megawatts of renewable capacity every year that we need to build if we're serious about hitting that target. And if we fail, I hope failure is not an option, but if that doesn't happen, then we would need to compensate with more thermal capacity. Otherwise, we could face a shortage. No? So that's the task ahead of us, but it's an exciting one, and we should just have a point of view and go for it. No?
One comment that we have been receiving from our followers, from our from those who go to our Facebook page, is that while it's great that we have the drive to raise our RE capacity locally and globally, the common criticism that we hear is that RE lacks baseload capacity. So how do RE developers like Ascent address this comment?
Yeah, no, I agree that the challenge of renewables, especially when it comes to solar and wind, the intermittent renewables, is the lack of reliability or dispatchability. No, you're dependent on when the wind blows and when the sun shines. It is a fact of life, and that is why we maintain that during this transition, we still need the transition fuel such as thermal. We've always advocated a balanced approach to the energy transition. We are not, much as we are big proponents of renewables, we don't think that renewables alone is the answer. At least it's not going to happen overnight. Of course, the big enabler, the holy grail of renewables to really unlock the massive potential of renewables is energy storage. So once we get energy storage at a cost and the proper scale, then it's going to be game on. And we believe that renewables will not only be able to provide mid-merit or peaking capacity, but also a baseload capacity. We did study this already. In fact, we submitted a bid in earlier this year for a renewable baseload. It does work. It's hard to scale. I will admit that. We can do a few hundred megawatts, but to talk about thousands of megawatts of baseload renewables driven by solar and wind is going to be tough. No, I think it can happen over time, but we need energy storage to come down in price and increase in competitiveness. We're not there yet. To give you an idea, Francis, our estimate is that, energy storage today, given a 4 to 6 hour storage capacity, would cost around $250,000 per megawatt hour. Okay. But for it to be competitive, at least from a mid-merit standpoint, so that it will be able to store during the day and release the energy at night, we would need to see that cost cut by half, at least, to about $125,000 per megawatt hour or even lower, so that storage at that point in time can be used to complement renewables and compete at the mid-merit level, on a 12-hour per day level. It needs to come down even further if you want it to be a 24-hour baseload capacity. But we're hopeful that this is something that will happen in the next, God knows when. No? 3 years would be the fastest. 5 years would be reasonable. 7 years would be quite arguably a conservative estimate as to when storage will get to that level.
All right, that's great to hear. And then, Nick, and then also, you recently said that you've consolidated your assets. You've upped your stake in the Ilocos wind farms, and you're also up to building solar projects left and right. But some of our followers are also asking, which between wind and solar are you prioritizing?
Well, both of the above.
Both. Okay, so equal.
I think there's a slight over-indexing on solar. If you look at our portfolio today on renewables, we have roughly twice the size of solar relative to our wind in terms of installed capacity, right? But in terms of output, it's probably equal given that wind capacity factor is almost double that of solar. Now, from an output perspective, I think it's more like 50-50 between wind and solar. And I think at the end of the day, it really depends by market, Francis. So, for example, in the Philippines, I would imagine that we would be having significantly more solar than wind, although we are also investing in wind. Because in the case of the Philippines, solar produces at the right time of the year. It peaks during summer when we need the capacity most. And it also peaks during the day, which is also the highest demand or among the highest demand during the day. So whereas wind produces mostly during the cooler season, the peak of wind months here in the Philippines is October to March, which is, relatively low demand. At least the fourth quarter is relatively, between November and February, traditionally is relatively low demand. So it's not that ideal, although, of course, from a portfolio perspective, I think wind will help us stabilize the overall renewable portfolio as well. So I think, but in the case of Australia, for example, They've got really good, excellent wind regime, almost like base load, very steady, and so forth. So in that particular market, I think we would also build a lot of wind farms relative to solar. I think it's going to be neck and neck between wind and solar. So I think it depends by market and by situation.
All right, sir. Now, speaking of solar, you mentioned solar earlier, and you mentioned your project in Cagayan.
Yes.
Any more details, sir, that you could share with us about the developments with that project?
Well, we're in the middle of hopefully finalizing the EPC contract, the construction contract, and just looking at ticking the rest of the boxes to before we issue the notice to proceed. But it's quite imminent. Hopefully, in the next few months, we should be able to issue the notice to proceed in a way that will allow us to complete the project prior to the summer of 2023. So the good thing about renewables is once your project is shovel ready, it just takes about 1 year to build a meaningfully sized power plant so that you can respond to potential tightness of supply, such as what we're seeing in the next 3 years could be tight unless we can really deploy a lot of these renewable projects off the ground soon to alleviate any power shortage in the next 2 to 3 years.
All right. And then also, still on solar, we've also received comments on our posts regarding anything regarding solar. A lot of people have raised concerns about the development of solar farms on arable land specifically. So their concerns center on their concerns center around let's say sana nagtanim na lang kami ng crops or something, and it would have been used for something else. Why put solar panels there? And also the communities. There's also issue with the communities. How does ASEN intend to address these concerns?
Yeah. So first of all, we only put solar farms on non-irrigated land. So we want to make sure that the land doesn't have a strong agricultural use. No. So in fact, one of our major projects is on land that is covered by Lahar, no? The one in Zambales.
Yes, no? Zambales.
Yeah. So there, that is unquestionable that we are not crowding out any potential agricultural use. So we're very sensitive to this. Of course, with the communities, we also have a policy and are part of our culture to work with our communities, not disrupt them, but to embrace them and involve them in the development. We provide labor, of course, but also the livelihood components. As you will notice, in some of our major developments in the north, for example, in Ilocos Norte, we have around our wind farms, we have what we call the conservation estate around the Pagudpud and our Bangi wind farms. No? So where we work with the communities and make sure that we have a program that will nurture the ecosystem, the biodiversity. We do reforestation and forest protection as well, and we involve the communities. We also do some agroforestry training programs, for instance, that provides livelihood and so forth. No? So it's a very high level of engagement. We incorporate this in our sustainability practice. So we don't only focus on building renewable energy plants, but we're also sensitive to the fact that when we build these plants, we typically interact with nature and communities and want to make sure that the biodiversity community needs, environmental protection are all part and parcel of our program. Similar thing with our Alaminos solar storage hybrid project, where we partnered with the community and Ayala Land. There's a carbon forest surrounding it, which is a project championed by Ayala Land. We also promoted the circular economy. So, for example, all the plastic waste from all of those solar panels are recycled and upcycled to be used as eco bricks for the building structures of our solar plant there. So, and even after the project is constructed, during operational phase, we are continuing the circular economy and making sure that there's waste management program deployed across the community, the greater community. So we in each of our major projects, we do incorporate these sustainability elements as well.
Just a curious question, because we have some we have investors also who follow Power Philippines, and these investors have seen the stellar rise of AC Energy stock price in the PSE. That we have received some comments such as let me quote this: "Isend lang ang salakam, malakas daw, malakas daw kayo." Is it time indeed to invest in RE and in ASEN? And of course, your comment, your comment to that, sir.
Yeah, well, all I can say, Francis, is we have positioned and established ASEN as a platform that will be leading the charge in the renewable revolution and in this energy transition. And I think this is one of the mega trends in globally today, the energy transition and decarbonization. I believe that it will be a multi-decade phenomenon. I mean, just imagine all the net zero ambitions and goals. Just imagine having to replace all of the thermal plants over time at the right time and shift these plants to renewables, to clean sources of energy. It is a massive undertaking, and I believe that we will see renewables and sustainable investments grow at a clip of at least 20-30% compounded annual growth over the next couple of decades, if not more, as a total sector industry. So that is the industry that we are focusing on. It's also an industry that is arguably, hopefully, remains to be shock-proof in terms of economic shocks like the pandemic. We've seen how fast the recovery was in terms of electricity demand. So you have, on the one hand, the utility nature, the relatively low risk nature of renewables. And on the other hand, you've got the energy transition and all of this transformation happening over the next couple of decades. So yeah, it's an exciting time to be in this sector, and we and ASEN also has a increasing regional, if not global, footprint. While we maintain Philippines as our core market, as an extremely important market, it accounts for 40-50% of our business. But we don't limit our growth to the Philippines. We think that we have a role to play in the regional, if not in the future, the global energy transition. So I think it's a great time. It's a great sector to be participating in, and I think together with our partners, and we've been very strong with partnerships, we've demonstrated a lot of momentum and capability in terms of accelerating our scale up in the renewable space.
Okay. Now, at this point, we'd like to accommodate some questions that have been sent to us over the weekend. So let's start. Let's start with this question from Bri Lee. So Bri asks, How could ASEAN surpass the 5,000 megawatt target by 2025?
Yeah, as I said, Francis, I'm feeling quite confident that we would surpass this target. We're already at 2,500, close to 3,000, given our trajectory. What's important also is the pipeline. As I mentioned, our updated pipeline is already at 18,000 megawatts. Now, I'm not saying that all 18,000 will happen over the foreseeable future, but you need a large pipeline given the natural attrition as well among the projects. No, so I think we've got the right pipeline, number one. And number two, we have the balance sheet. We have quite a strong balance sheet owing to the recent capital raising and the new investors that we have in the platform. And we have a relatively low leverage. Our balance sheet, our debt equity ratio is only at 0.35 to 1 as of the last reporting period. So we do have the pipeline, the partnerships, and the balance sheet to keep on pushing. So I'm confident that we would not only meet, but again, hopefully exceed this target.
All right. And let's have our next question from RV Gel Ramos. RV asks how, after hitting the 5,000 megawatt renewable capacity for 2025, what's next for ASEAN?
Yeah, that's something that I think in the next year or a couple of years, we would start looking at 2030. Hopefully in the next year and a half, we'll set another aspirational target. To be quite frank, Francis, we set this 5,000 megawatt renewable target in early 2018 when our renewable portfolio was at 250 megawatts, right? So it sounded aspirational. It was aspirational back then to grow 20 times to 5,000 megawatts by 2025. Doesn't sound so aspirational anymore when you're already, 50% to your goal with 4 years to go. It sounds very achievable and lacking in aspiration. So rather than changing the target, I would rather take a look at the next milestone year, which would be 2030, and set a new aspirational target. Cannot announce that yet. I will have to get the commitment of my management team and the board, but hopefully in the next 6, 12, 18 months, we'll be able to communicate what that new BHAG is, that big, hairy, audacious goal by 2030.
And we'll be excited to hear that, sir.
We'll do another podcast for that.
We'll be looking forward to that, sir. Okay, next question from Jerome Wafalas. I hope I got that right, Jerome. What are the upcoming events that you are looking forward to in 2022? I think what he means here is that how much, or what's your outlook for 2022? And how much capacity are you targeting for next year? I think you answered that, sir, earlier. An additional, did I get the 3,000, sir?
I think by early part of 2022, we should, based on the projects that we already announced but haven't hit notice to proceed yet, we would be close to 3,000 megawatts of renewables in total. But that's not the end all and be all. I think the team will continue to work hard to convert a lot of this pipeline into projects under construction by 2022. So again, I cannot give a specific number, but we will suffice it to say that we will continue to push the envelope. Especially in the Philippines, that needs a lot of capacity. So beyond Cagayan, do expect us to be pushing more projects in the Philippines. And of course, we will also continue to expand our international business as well.
Thank you very much to all of you, for our followers, for sending us your questions for today. And basically, ASEAN is committed to net zero. They're going to have an all RE portfolio by 2025, and they are dropping coal from their portfolio. And on that note, thank you very much, ASEAN President and CEO Eric Francia, for joining us. We're very, very grateful to you for joining us in this first episode of Power Podcast. We hope to see you again, sir, in our next episode.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Francis, and congratulations on this new initiative of yours, and thanks for having me in your pilot episode.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much. And we wish you well at ASEAN. We wish you well, sir. And that wraps up today's Power Podcast. Tune in next time as we converse with the movers and shakers of the country's energy sector. For your comments and suggestions, shoot us a message on Power Philippines Facebook Messenger account or email us at news.powerphilippines@gmail.com. And of course, be updated on the country's energy sector by visiting www.powerphilippines.com and by liking us on Facebook. If you want to view this podcast again, check out our YouTube channel at Power Philippines News. Again, that's Power Philippines News on YouTube. I'm Francis Respicio. Have a powerful day ahead.